Hello and welcome to the Women's Hour. My name is Kelly Pyle. I am your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. Today's show features articles from the March 10th issue of People Magazine and the February edition of Real Simple. A few of the articles I will be sharing with you today include Ellen Pompeo, How She Found Her Groove, The Sound of Music Turns 60, and Tips for Traveling Without Your Pup. Ellen Pompeo, How She Found Her Groove. The Grey's Anatomy star, who fought to become one of TV's highest paid actresses, reflects on keeping it real as a wife and a mom of three, and looks ahead with a daring new role. By Julie Jordan, Photographs, by Johnny Marlowe. This is a People Magazine exclusive. Ellen Pompeo's 15-year-old daughter, Stella Luna, is watching her mom expertly navigate an on-camera interview at a photo shoot. The two frequently make eye contact as Pompeo, 55, answers questions with humor and a no-nonsense sensibility. Asked to describe herself as a mother, the actress laughs. "Oh my goodness, my kid is sitting right there staring at me," she says. "It depends on what day you get me. But I can tell you it's my favorite thing that I am, and it's really all that matters to me." After 20 years on television's longest-running primetime medical drama, Grey's Anatomy, Pompeo, who's also mom to daughter Sienna Mae, 10, and son Eli Christopher, 8, with her husband, sportswear executive Chris Ivory, 57, has learned who she is and what she wants. Having joined the show in 2005, she fought for a radical $20 million contract in 2017 that made her the highest paid dramatic actress on television. And while she hasn't scrubbed out of Grey's for good, she's still appearing in a handful of episodes each season. She is focused on her future. Now she's taking a dramatic leap by starring in Hulu's new limited series, Good American Family, premieres March 19th, which tackles the twisted, true crime story of Natalia Grace. Told from multiple points of view, the show revolves around a Midwestern couple who adopt a Ukrainian child with a rare form of dwarfism. In time, they become suspicious that she's actually an adult and their lives are in danger. It was like, wow, this is intense. How would we pull this off? And I said, like I say often, this isn't for me, recalls Pompeo, who plays adoptive mother Christine Barnett. And then everyone around me convinces me that this is something you definitely should do. While the role is a huge departure from her Grey's character, Pompeo drew upon her own life experience. "I think all mothers have the intention to love their children endlessly and to do everything in their power to give their children the best chance. I have three children of my own, so a mother's love and passion was where I started from." The youngest of six siblings, raised in a very blue-collar, working-class Boston neighborhood, Pompeo was 4 when her mom, Kathleen, died from an accidental painkiller overdose. "As a kid, I remember myself being really sad all the time," she says. "But then I see pictures of myself, and I was always laughing and looked really happy. So I don't know if I've just always been an actress." In high school, Pompeo was not popular. I definitely wasn't a cool girl cheerleader with big boobs, she recalls. I didn't go to the prom or do any of that. Her interest in acting was piqued after being mesmerized seeing the Rockettes with her aunt at Radio City Music Hall. And I remember watching Michelle Pfeiffer in movies and saying, "Who is that and how do I do that?" After high school graduation, Pompeo worked in Miami and New York City as a bartender before booking commercials and independent films. She won her first television role on Law & Order in 1996. Smaller parts in films followed until her breakthrough in 2003's hit comedy Old School. Her intended career path in movies took a sharp turn when she was offered the role of Meredith Grey. Premiering in March 2005, the show became an overnight sensation and shot Pompeo to instant stardom. Her 2017 contract negotiation also included a share of the show's profits and commitments for her production company, Calamity Jane. The notoriously private Pompeo was vocal about her fight and victory in the media. Men talk about whatever they want, and we've been told it's uncouth to talk about money, she explains. Or if you complain, you are difficult or crazy. The actress also hoped her words would empower other women who want to speak up and show up authentically about inequities, wherever it is, she adds. As a white woman, as a working actress, as a person who's super well compensated, if people that sit with privilege can't use it to better the lives of others, you really don't deserve it. While Meredith moved to Boston to research Alzheimer's disease in season 19, Pompeo still appears on and narrates the show, for which she serves as an executive producer. The best thing is financial security, if I'm being very honest, she says of her longevity. It's been really lucrative, and I think financial security is not something that every actress is afforded, so I'm very grateful for that. As for any challenges, Pompeo points to the repetitive nature of doing the same thing over and over, she explains. There's a familiarity that people love, so we can't change it too much. I'm always like, let's do this and let's do that. And they're like, shut up, Ellen, we're not doing that. So people love the familiarity, and familiarity breeds contempt. Still, Pompeo admits it's the fandom that really lends insight into the show's impact. What's extraordinary is that it has spawned thousands of surgeons, she says. People tell me they've gone into the field of medicine because of Grey's all the time, and it's part of what's kept me on the show for so long. It really does touch people for the better. Well, before Pompeo's Grey's stardom, she and Ivory were introduced in 2003 by a mutual friend in a grocery store, and the two eventually began dating. Married 4 years later, they're now headed towards their 18th anniversary. Having a long marriage is not easy. There's a lot of hard days, the actress admits. All relationships take work. Everything has its ebbs and flows and ups and downs, and it's okay to have bad days. You've just got to try to find the love and blow the little things off. Having lost her own mom so young, Pompeo welcomed any perspective that could be gleaned when she had kids. What's interesting about not having a mother around is that I always thought having her would be the answer to all my problems. And then you grow up and into the world and meet people who have terrible relationships with their mothers. Like, wait, what? There's people that don't get along with their mothers? There's no roadmap to being a parent. While she embraces raising her kids in LA for its creativity, Pompeo has allowed only Stella to watch Grey's. What happens is all the classmates start watching, and then it gets awkward, she says. I still think there's a lot of inappropriate stuff that 10-year-olds should not be seeing. No judgment on other parents, but I just don't want to answer questions like, so why are your panties on the bulletin board? If she could share any hard-earned wisdom with her younger self, Pompeo would simply offer reassurance. I was so skinny, and everyone thought I had an eating disorder. I had so much anxiety and lacked self-esteem because people were so critical of my physicality, she says. I just remember being so anxious on red carpets and the comments about my weight and my body. Maybe, hopefully, things have changed, because it was brutal 20 years ago. While most grateful for her health, I've outlived my mother by 15 years, Pompeo has learned she's pretty resilient when it comes to Hollywood. I'm sort of like a blue-collar worker, right? I go to a TV show, and I'm not the cool kid or the popular kid necessarily. I'm kind of a worker bee. I think that's been good for me. A big believer in destiny and fate, Pompeo trusts that her journey is the one that I've been meant to have. I feel quite peaceful about where I've been and what I've done, and I'm really excited about what lies ahead. 20 years of Grey's, Meredith's greatest hits. Shock and awe. Meredith removed a bomb from a patient's chest, but it detonated in the hallway while a police specialist held it in season 2. Friends until the end. Her ride or die colleague, Christina Yang, left after accepting a job in Switzerland in season 10. Taking home the gold. In season 14, she found out she won the prestigious Harper Avery Award, recognizing her growth as a surgeon. Afterlife reunion. Meredith and Derek Shepherd, Patrick Dempsey, who died in season 11, were reunited in a dream in season 17. New love. Sparks flew when Meredith met transplant surgeon Nick Marsh, played by Scott Speedman, in season 14, but they didn't get together until season 18. Lightning round. Favorite time of day. I'm definitely a morning person. I have energy, I'm excited, I'm optimistic. 7:30 p.m., I'm like, leave me alone. Strangest superstition. I was raised Italian-Irish Catholic, so all of them. Can't walk under the ladder, Friday the 13th. I'm kind of superstitious about things. Chore you dread. Doing the dishes. I just have to rinse them and put them in the dishwasher, but I don't like it. Last time you cried. I was listening to my son sing Count on Me by Bruno Mars. He used to sing it with a friend of mine who passed away last year, and it was kind of heartbreaking. I'm a really emotional person, so I cry all the time. What makes you laugh the hardest? Probably my kids. Biggest pet peeve? Ignorant people. How would you describe this chapter of your life right now? Fabulous. From anxious teen to icon. Finding her way. As a student at Everett High School, I was pretty awkward and introverted, Pompeo says. I think the kids now would call it emo. Breakthrough role. Pompeo played the high school crush of Luke Wilson's character in the 2003 hit comedy Old School with Will Ferrell and Vince Vaughn. The doctor is in. The actress won the role of the title character on ABC's Grey's Anatomy in 2005 and continues to produce and act in the long-running series. Testing new waters. Pompeo takes on the role of controversial real-life mom Christine Barnett in Hulu's Good American Family. You've been listening to a People magazine exclusive, Ellen Pompeo, How She Found Her Groove. The Sound of Music turns 60 as the Julie Andrews classic hits a major milestone. Actors share their favorite memories from behind the scenes. By Jen Juno from People magazine. Life imitated art on the set of The Sound of Music, the beloved musical that debuted in movie theaters on March 2, 1965. In the adaptation of the Broadway hit, Julie Andrews starred as kindly governess Maria, who looked after the 7 Von Trapp children in Austria at the dawn of World War II. Andrews, then 29 and an up-and-coming actress, also took a motherly role off-camera when it comes to the young actors who played the children. She was kind of a nanny for us, recalls Duane Chase, who played mischievous Kurt Von Trapp. She helped, I wouldn't say keep us in line, but corralled us. Kim Carath, also known as Gretel Von Trapp, the youngest sibling, remembers Andrews, now 89, teaching them to sing Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, a tune from her upcoming movie Mary Poppins, before that film was even released. She amused us a lot, says Carath. To mark the milestone anniversary of The Sound of Music, which went on to win the Best Picture Oscar, 20th Century Fox unearthed archival photos from behind the scenes. Though six decades have passed since the cast, some of whom have died, including Christopher Plummer, who played the stern Von Trapp patriarch, spent a magical few months together on the sets in LA and Europe, it's clear it was a special time for all involved. Says Chase, I am incredibly blessed to have been a part of that. The hills are alive with clouds. Poor weather focused Heather Menzies and Andrews, Duane Chase, Kim Carath, and Charmaine Carr to take a break while filming the Do-Re-Mi picnic scene in Austria. We were waiting out the overcast, recalls Chase. A perfect match. They were both very witty, Carath says of Andrews and Christopher Plummer, practicing his performance of Edelweiss during a rehearsal. I think that was one of the sources of their wonderful chemistry. A few of their favorite things. Nicholas Hammond and on-screen brother Chase were gifted fancy skateboards by the son of a crew member, Chase says. Pulling strings. Professional puppeteers rehearsed the lonely goat herd scene with Angela Cartwright, Menzies, Hammond, Debbie Turner, and Chase. No problems with Maria, She was really warm and congenial and loving, patient and very sweet, Carath says of Andrews. This has been The Sound of Music Turns 60 from People Magazine. Rick Springfield, What I Know Now. Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll at 75. The 80s icon gets candid about aging, secrets to a lasting marriage, and 44 years of fame after Jesse's Girl by Breanne Tracy from People. With perfectly intact swooping hair, chiseled abs, and swoon-worthy vocals, Rick Springfield is still living up to his heartthrob title at 75. And yet, the rocker has never felt connected to his status as an 80s darling. I can't really relate to it, Springfield admits over the phone from his Malibu home. It's what other people put on me. People also put on me that I was a one-dimensional soap opera actor that got lucky with one song. All I can do is be me and try and do the best work that I can. Since he rose to fame in 1981, both for his number one hit, Jesse's Girl, and for his role as Dr. Noah Drake on the daytime soap General Hospital, the Australian native has proved naysayers wrong, remaining a steady presence in music and on screen with 25 million albums sold throughout his career, and roles in films like Ricky and the Flash with Meryl Streep in 2015. Most recently, he released Volume 2 of his Greatest Hits album, and he will set out on his way on his I Want My 80s tour on May 28th. I still feel like I'm in my 20s in my head, he says of his busy schedule. Then I see people dying from old age and disease and go, wow, I'm the same age as old people. Outside of his career, Springfield, who has battled depression since he was a teen, has become an outspoken mental health advocate. Sharing has helped me a lot, he says. I want people to know they're not alone. By his side, through it all, has been his wife of 40 years, Barbara Porter, 61, with whom he shares sons Liam, 39, and Joshua, 36. She's been my rock, and I've been her rock, he says. It trades off. Here, Springfield shares his musings on his lasting marriage, mortality, and experimenting with drugs as treatment for depression. Success isn't always good for your mental health. It was the unexpected moment of having the things that I thought would heal me and them not healing me. You need to look inward and not to get a better car or a more expensive house or a younger wife or whatever. Lately, I've been doing things like walking along the beach with my wife and my dog. Things that I used to think, that's a waste of time. I should be in the studio or doing something constructive. The healing part has been allowing myself to do things and not berating myself for wasting time. I'm claiming time by doing it now. Drugs aren't just for partying. Recently, I tried ketamine. I wanted to see if it would open a few things in my brain. It was a creative experiment and an experiment on depression. I did it for as long as it was suggested, and I wasn't a big fan. It made me feel heavy and machine-like. It didn't change much in me, although I have been writing a lot, so you never know what kind of effect it has later on. It's not a black and white kind of thing. I'm still interested in microdosing. I did acid, and that was actually a little better. I hadn't done that since I was in my 20s, but it was a great high. I don't mean to push drugs on anyone, but I'm not averse to anything that helps me be happier and a better person. I could use some help in that area. I'm always searching. You can always reevaluate your relationship with drinking. About 2 years ago, I cut back on alcohol, and that has actually helped more than anything. I was drinking quite a bit, and as you get older, it's kind of a natural thing to drop all that stuff. I'm not in AA. I mean, I know a lot of people it's worked for. I'll have a couple sips of vodka or something when I'm on stage, but I don't drink any other time. Abs are possible at 75. I exercise every day, and every time I play with my band, it is a 2-hour aerobic workout. On the road, we're Planet Fitness whores. Planet Fitness is like the Holiday Inn of workout places. They're all the same every place you go. The focus of tour used to be partying and getting laid. Now it's getting enough sleep and finding a nice restaurant. Always assume the thing you and your partner are fighting over is bull stuff. Sometimes me and Barbara start arguing, and then we stop and start laughing because it's a familiar pattern and we know it means nothing. Most of our arguments are about things we love, like the dog or a kid, but we always make up. There have been tough times when we've tried to find a third person to talk to, and I think that's really important. I guess if anyone asks, how do you stay married, I just say, don't get divorced. That's really all it is. Death in the family makes you take stock of your own health. A lot of people don't want to know what's wrong with them. I'm the opposite. My dad died from not wanting to know. He thought he had stomach cancer for years and never got it checked out. When he finally collapsed one day at home, they found out it was an ulcer that burst, and he died from the loss of blood. It could have been fixed if he had gotten it checked out. That was a giant message to me. If you want to live long, you have to be prepared for some bad news now and then. I did the pre-nuvo whole body MRI scan, and I found out I have some brain damage from a fall I took on stage in Las Vegas in 2000. I'm working on trying to repair that. But mortality shouldn't be scary. It's not a death wish by any stretch, but it is important to be aware of it. I think I have a better handle on dying than I used to. I've faced it a couple of times, but my heart still jumps into my mouth when the plane drops. I'm not as evolved as I like to think. You can only put on the party dress, but what happens at the party is up to the gods. 4 decades of rocking on. Paging Dr. Drake. Springfield says General Hospital was his first steady paycheck. It was intoxicating. Heartthrob era. Springfield jokes that because of Jesse's Girl, which earned him a Grammy in 1982, I'll never be able to shed the 80s attachment. Fountain of Youth. Springfield says he sees his age as a number. You've been listening to Rick Springfield, What I Know Now, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll at Age 75, from People. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer broadcaster, Kelly Pyle, and this is the Women's Hour. The Tony I Knew. Anthony Bourdain's former assistant. Laurie Wolliver worked alongside the late chef and TV host for 9 years and became a trusted friend. Now she reveals their story for the first time. By Anna Calderone. This is from People magazine. 5 minutes before her Zoom interview with People is scheduled to start, Laurie Wolliver is logged on and ready to talk. Her boss, the late Anthony Bourdain, was notoriously punctual. And now, if I'm not 5 minutes early, I'm late, she says with a shrug. Wolliver, 50, was Bourdain's assistant from 2009 until his death by suicide in 2018. She managed the life of the most traveled man on TV, co-wrote his books, and acted as his publicist. She was his Luca Brasi from The Godfather, he'd joke. Assistant maybe doesn't feel like the most accurate title, she says of her relationship with the chef turned writer and host. Chief of staff, but it was a staff of one. In a job so intimate, Wolliver and Bourdain, whom she referred to only as Tony, developed a working relationship and a trusted friendship. For years, I have had these dreams where he comes back, and it turns out that it was just a big ruse where he decided to disappear for a while, she says. And I'm in the position of helping him get reacclimated into life. She has a running list of things she'd love to tell him. Wouldn't it be great if that dream was real? And I got to be the one to say, dude, there was a pandemic in 2020, and you would not believe what is happening with global politics right now. There's this show, Succession, that I think you would love, and The Bear. Her time with Bourdain is detailed in Wolliver's new memoir, Care and Feeding, out March 11th. But it's not a typical tell-all, behind-the-scenes assistance memoir, she clarifies. Instead, her anecdotes, like one hectic excursion to produce a bucket of KFC in Sri Lanka so they could eat fried chicken and drink whiskey on the hotel roof, are woven within her story of parenting, infidelity, and addiction. There are other famous names too. After graduating from the French Culinary Institute in 1998, she was Chef Mario Batali's assistant. Wolliver recalls both positive and negative experiences, including the time she claims he groped her during the workday in front of waitstaff at his restaurant. Batali was later accused by more than 20 women of sexual harassment. He settled the case. He wielded his power, sometimes in a really ugly way, she says. But I can also see that he, for me personally, also used his power to help me out. Batali recommended her to Bourdain when she was ready to move on to a new job. Wolliver had an active journal practice, which became her guide when she was ready to write her own story. She also had years of emails and texts with Bourdain to reference. In June 2018, she had what would be her final exchange with Bourdain. He was filming an episode of CNN's Parts Unknown in Alsace, France, when paparazzi photos revealed that his girlfriend, actress, and film director Asia Argentino was allegedly having an affair. We talked about that, and then also about very normal things, like, let's schedule this doctor's appointment. It's hard to reconcile that he believed he would be back in New York, and then he wasn't. Wolliver reviews her memoir as her detaching from the role as Tony's assistant, but still welcomes reminders of their time together. I have Tony's laser printer. I use it all the time, and I think of him. Keeping his legacy alive. Wolliver has published 2 Bourdain books, World Travel, which they started together before his death in 2018, and Bourdain, the definitive oral biography. I'm happy to see that there's so much interest in him and that people are still getting a lot of meaning out of his work, she says. It's such a comfort to see that he's still so beloved in this world. Thanks for the company. In an exclusive excerpt from Care and Feeding, a memoir, Lori Wolliver offers a look inside her relationship with Anthony Bourdain and the weeks leading up to his death by suicide. In 2002, her then boss, Mario Batali, suggested Wolliver help Anthony Bourdain write his new cookbook. I expected him to be a French-inflected version of Mario, a man play-acting as a pirate, swaggering, maybe a little handsy, probably quite mean. I steeled myself, but in the warmth of his welcome and his overt gratitude for my taking the job, in his theatrical self-effacement and his slight endearing awkwardness, Tony thwarted every one of my expectations. For the many months that we worked in tandem on the Les Halles cookbook, Tony and I had communicated only by email. Shortly before the final manuscript was due, he asked me to meet him at his home to do a last round of recipe edits in person. When I arrived at his place, mid-morning on a Tuesday, he answered the door in bare feet, wearing jeans and a long-sleeved gray thermal shirt, holding a lit cigarette. For about an hour, we worked through a checklist of outstanding changes, edits, and queries in the recipes. When we finished, he handed me a personal check for $3,000. An amount unrelated to any money I had invoiced him for. "You've done outstanding work," he said, and it took me a moment to understand that he was giving me a bonus. Bourdain hired her to be his assistant. More than 6 months passed before I saw him in person at a poetry reading. Shortly before the reading started, I spotted Tony entering the auditorium from the back. As I approached him and he saw me, I saw in the slightly defensive set of his face and body language that he didn't recognize me. "Hi, I'm your assistant, Lori Wolliver," I said, holding out my hand to shake his. He looked startled and then laughed, his face now slightly sheepish. Wolliver and Bourdain's working relationship evolved into a friendship. We had dinner at a Thai restaurant, and we were murdered with food, about twice as much as what we had ordered, and almost all of it spicy in a way that inflicted pain that then gave way to an endorphin rush of pleasure. After dinner, as he shifted a rumbling Challenger into park outside the hotel garage, Tony said, "Thanks for the company," which startled me. I'd assumed that Tony took me to dinner out of a sense of professional obligation, and that he would always rather be alone, given his slight but enduring awkwardness in unstructured social situations. That he would prefer company to being alone at dinner was new information. Bourdain went public with his girlfriend, actress Asia Argento, in May 2017. Tony called midweek, asking me to handle a situation with the New York Post. An Italian tabloid had just published a story about Tony and his new girlfriend, Asia Argento, complete with a Roman Street canoodle photo, and the Post wanted to be the first with the story in the U.S. Verbally confirm with the reporter that it's true, nothing more, and don't leave any fingerprints that this info came from our camp, he said. Successfully managing this bit of business was the highlight of my week. Wolliver said Bourdain was in obsessive love with Argentino. He had me frequently ship gifts to her home, the first of which was a large box of vinyl records, hand-selected from various record stores around town, a sweet and geeky gesture of love. Unfortunately, I hadn't anticipated the very steep import duties to be paid on such a gift, nor the multiple copies of forms she was required to print and complete before FedEx Italia would release the package into her hands. She told Tony, with frank annoyance, that it was all too big of a hassle and had the box returned to him. Find another way to get them to her, said Tony, who didn't have to curse or yell for me to know that he was deeply disappointed by my F-up. In June 2018, Wolliver got a Google alert that photos of Argento kissing a French journalist had been published. National Enquirer asked for her comment. When I asked Tony what he'd like me to do about the Enquirer, he said, ignore it and ignore any similar queries from other pubs, but let me know when the Enquirer piece drops. A parts unknown producer, Helen, had heard that things were apparently tense on set in France, and everyone was walking the tightrope, trying to give him both the emotional support he seemed to need and the space to process his pain with a measure of private dignity. The next day, Tony asked me to schedule a number of things for him, a lunch, a haircut, a doctor appointment, a private session with his jiu-jitsu trainer for the week after his return to New York. I hope you're doing okay, I texted to him, and when he responded, I'll live and we'll survive, I assumed that the we meant him and Asia, their complicated relationship. At 4:25 the next morning, my phone vibrated on the windowsill next to my bed, waking me from a light sleep. It was Kim, Tony's agent. When I answered the call, she said, Tony has taken his life. I thought, we can fix this. I'd spent the last 9 years, and Kim much longer than that, helping Tony meet his obligations, get where he needed to be. We could. We had to help him un-F the mess he made when he effing hung himself in his hotel room, just like he had glibly threatened to do a million times in the face of something as minor as a bad hamburger or a delayed flight. Wolliver and Bourdain's fans around the world processed his death. It was all quite a lot. The t-shirts, the candles, the posters, the bake sales, and cookouts and Negroni specials to raise money for suicide prevention work. The restaurant that created Bourdain fries topped with escargot, pernod, absinthe, butter, and shredded Gruyere? I could almost hear Tony groaning and speculating about the tensile strength of the overhead beams using his comedy voice. From Care and Feeding by Lori Wolliver, copyright 2025 by Lori Wolliver, excerpted by permission of Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. You've been listening to Anthony Bourdain's former assistant, the Tony I knew, from People magazine. Pets, tips for traveling without your pup. Because unfortunately, you can't always take him on vacation with you. By Dana McMahon from Real Simple magazine. Before you go, first up, find the right sitter. Lean on friends or family if possible, suggests Whitney Miller, DVM, chief veterinarian at Petco. You already know and trust them, and most likely so does your dog. If no one is available or up to the task, Miller says to ask your vet. They may be able to recommend someone or even have staff who pets it. Or ask your neighbors who they like. Definitely check references for someone new. And in addition to holding a meet and greet, consider doing a trial run, like an overnight, says Trish McMillan, a certified animal behavior professional in Mars Hill, North Carolina. Don't start with a 2-week trip to Africa, she wisely points out. While we never like to think about something bad happening, it's critical to prepare for the worst. Experts agree that your dog's microchip registration and collar identification tags need to be up to date should Haldini get loose. And in the event that your pup becomes sick or injured, make sure there's a credit card on file at the vet. You don't want to put it on your sitter to cover the cost, Miller says. But what if the sitter has their own emergency? Having a backup who can step in if absolutely necessary, she adds. Next, provide instructions and don't worry about going overboard. It's way better to have too much detail than not enough, McMillan says. List emergency contacts and write out your pet's schedule, Miller suggests. It's all about trying to keep their routine as possible, she says, which can alleviate anxiety. Include notes on food and meds, and stock up on more than they'll need. If the sitter is staying in your home, don't forget to give the Wi-Fi information and explain any quirks of the space. Finally, if you anticipate that Captain Clingy will have separation anxiety, give your vet a call, says Lindsay Hamrick, Director of Shelter Outreach and Engagement for the Humane Society of the United States. They can decide if a prescription calming aid would be helpful, she says. When it's time to leave, before you hit the road, you have to do the hard thing. Look into Doggy Hauser's sweet, sad eyes and say you're leaving without him. Be sure he's had a good walk or lots of exercise that morning, Hamrick says, explaining that the more tired pets are, the less anxiety they tend to have. To minimize the anxiety even more, wait to bring out the suitcases until it's almost time to go. And though you'll want to smother him with sorrowful nuzzles, dogs feed off that, Hamrick says, so try not to make your departure a big deal. Give him a quick hug and pretend you're just leaving to go grocery shopping. If you're using a prescription calming aid, let it kick in before you go. Otherwise, toss him a favorite toy to distract him while you step out, Miller says. And if you're not doing an immediate handoff to the sitter, consider putting on some classical music, McMillan suggests, or running a fan for white noise to help mask any outside sounds he may react to. With that last hug, double check that his collar is secure. While you're away, when it comes to your separation anxiety, be clear about your communication expectations, Hamrick says. The sitter may think they'll disturb your vacation with a photo of sleeping Mick Jagger when you're really on the edge of your seat waiting for the next missive. With someone new, it's appropriate to ask for morning and evening updates, Hamrick says. Beyond that, she adds, tell them what kinds of things are important to tell you, such as eating habits, poop happenings or not happenings, and any atypical behavior. When you finally reunite, yay, you're about to be together again. You're overjoyed, but as with your departure, McMillan advises trying to stay even keeled. Can't? Hamrick recommends taking it outside. It's confusing for dogs if you usually don't want them to go wild when people come into the house, but then you encourage it on this occasion, she explains. If you're feeling guilty about leaving your furry BFF behind, remember that fun vacations help recharge us, Miller says. That old saying about filling your cup before you can pour it out for others applies to your pet too. If we're our best selves when we come back, Miller notes, we'll have a renewed energy that will for sure be felt by our pet. This has been Tips for Traveling Without Your Pup from Real Simple Magazine. Minor issues, major opinions. Is it okay to recline your seat on an airplane? Everyone's got thoughts. We collected yours, then called on the experts to settle the debate once and for all. By Naomi Barr from Real Simple. Readers say, nope, no way. That little bit of space doesn't help me. Not worth making someone's flight miserable. From Kellyanne Longport. Airlines need to get rid of that option. No good comes of it. From Catherine Crowley 98. Why is it that people recline like it's their birthright? Unless your knees are so far up into your chest that they're cutting off blood flow, the answer is always no. By A.K. Williams 918. Sure, why not? I always lean back, but not so much as to bother the person behind me. They must be able to eat, watch a movie, work on a laptop, and get up comfortably enough to go to the restroom. Live and let others live as well. By Lorenka Finta. I paid for the seat. I can use the functions attached to it. By Debbie Jenkins. Everyone should recline. Then we're all even. By Peace Dog 2020. The experts. The experts say, unanimously, yes, it is your right to recline your seat. Just don't be a jerk about it, says Henry Hartvelt, an airline and travel industry analyst. Airplanes are shared spaces, he adds, explaining that we need to be considerate of our fellow passengers. Elaine Swan, an etiquette expert and the founder of the Swan School of Protocol and a former flight attendant, agrees. Her advice, before you lean your seat back, check if your neighbor behind you has a drink or laptop there. If they do, to keep the peace, give them a heads up that you're about to recline. Then do it slowly, Swan says, so they're not shocked by a sudden lurch. And definitely move the seat forward during the meal service. And maybe only lean back as much as it takes to feel comfy. If you're looking for the most space possible, upgrading to a seat with extra legroom may be worth it. Or book early to get an exit row seat if you're up for it. You could also follow this insider tip, which we got from a flight attendant at a major airline who asked to go only by Emmanuel. Choose a seat as close to the front of the plane as you can. On many aircrafts, like some 737s, as you move toward the back of the plane, say from the wings on, the plane becomes skinnier, so those seats tend to be tighter, which can translate to less lateral legroom, he says. It's a slight difference, but that's usually where negotiations between customers have to happen. So to maximize space between you and the seat in front of you, and to hopefully avoid conflict, book early and book up front. This has been Minor Issues, Major Opinions. Is it okay to recline your seat on an airplane? From Real Simple. Thanks for joining us today for the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, and I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. I hope you enjoyed the stories today, and I also hope you'll make plans to join us again next week for another interesting and hopefully entertaining collection of Women's Magazine articles. And don't forget, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can stream as well as access shows on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Have a great day, and be sure to stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.